So I wanted to talk today about bodhisattva power, the power of bodhisattvas. And it felt like a continuation of some of the things Aviv was saying last night about the power of seeing, the power of looking, the power of opening ourselves as fully as we can to whatever comes our way as we walk through this life. And at some image, at some point yesterday, he used an image of whatever we do, wherever we are, in whatever way. I'm probably misquoting, but you'll forgive me. We have to be ready for that ride that can come along, a trimp. And when Aviv said it, I had this image in my mind of the bodhisattva bus, which is kind of a psychedelic, in my imagination anyway, kind of 60s big colorful thing that kind of stops and just the door opens and there's music and we can hop on if we want. And when I think of this power of seeing that Aviv was speaking about, that I'll be speaking about, it's a very soft power. And these are two words, two ideas that in our everyday reality we're not used to putting together. A power that is also soft. And a power that is just steady. And just a week ago, someone was telling me that they read about the creation of the Himalayan mountains. And I think most of us probably know that the Himalayan mountains were created by the meeting of two continents. And I don't know how you imagined it, but I always understood that it was like something very dramatic. Two continents meeting together and these mountains coming up. But actually, it seems, according to my source, who read it somewhere in his source, that it was a very slow process. And it's actually a process that's still happening. So not a big drama, but something very slow, very steady, which has created the biggest, the tallest mountains on our planet. Slow, continuous movement for years and years and years over time. And I was struck that these are the same qualities that work when we sit here. The same thing that creates the Himalayan mountains is also what works when we sit on the cushion or when we move in the world with an interest to look at our experience, to grow and to learn. Qualities of continuity, something that keeps going, and of fluidity and flexibility. Not just one thing that we do, but the ability to react differently to different situations. And I'm also continuously struck when I look at nature. And see so many examples of where softness is the strongest power. Continuity and fluidity, flexibility, are the strongest power. If we look at the earth, the strongest powers on the earth, two of them are water and wind. You can't hit against them. You move through. But by their constant movement around what they meet, they shape reality. They shape the reality that we all live in. Or sometimes we see a flower growing in the middle of a sidewalk or a road, just finding its way somehow to do the impossible, to grow through concrete. And we see that. We know it happens. And I always kind of want to ask the flower, how did you do that? Exactly. And so what do we learn? What can we take from this? It kind of, for me, always has this whisper of, can I work with instead of against? Work with what comes, what shows itself, what's happening, both internally in myself and externally in my relationships with others, in my relationship with life. Instead of against, instead of constantly hitting my head against a wall, can I just be something that works with, that cooperates, that dances, is another good image. And so this kind of attitude is very much the bodhisattva way. And it's a practice that's been around for many, many years. It's a practice that highlights, that emphasizes, taking anything that comes our way and seeing how we can make that a fertilizer for growth, for the growth of what we value in life, for what we care about in life. So, I have this image of these practices as growing trees. And the trees are rooted in daily life shit, in manure, in fertilizer. That's the roots. And they grow up and out to give shade, to give food, to give protection, to be resources for our deepest aspirations, for what we truly feel is worth living for. For what we truly feel the world should be. And these trees are also rooted in the softness within us, in our own vulnerability, in our own fragility, in the places within us that we usually hide or protect, in our deepest heart, which is also probably for most of us the most alive part of us, even if it's under many layers of protection. It's still very, very alive. deepest part of us that has the capacity to feel. Which for me is one of the amazing miracles of being alive, is that we actually feel. That we have this somewhere in this. I think no one's yet figured out exactly where. Is it here? Is it here? Is it here? You know, where is this part that actually feels? That feels pain, that feels care, that feels boredom, whatever it is. That part that reacts, that responds, that is touched. And many times, we can feel as if we have different areas that feel. So we make a difference between pain and love, or joy, or any other deep emotion. It feels like they're inherently different, they're separate. But when we really look into ourselves, we see that it's in the same place that we experience all of these. And this deep, tender part of ourselves does not know the difference between pain and love. It doesn't make a judgment between the two. But this place is so tender, so vulnerable, that most of the time we don't know how to hold it. We don't know what to do with it, really. So we do our best. And we do our best to protect this place from getting hurt. Or we let something in, and then it becomes too much. So we go hard, or we panic, or we despair. Whatever it is that we do. And I remembered recently, a memory that I think I suppressed for a very long time. And it was on one of my first trips to India. And I had just sat a month of silent meditation retreats in Bodh Gaya. My sense of bodhisattva heart was very strong. I really wanted to do. And so I moved along with a whole load of other travelers from Bodh Gaya, where the retreats were happening, to Varanasi, which is quite a busy city in northern India. And I'd made a friend that year. She was about 10 years younger than me. And she was doing volunteer work in a center for street children. So she was just going once a day for a few hours. And it was just a place where the kids could come and have some food and play some games. Just have a little bit of a break from being on the streets. And so my sense was, oh, I really want to do that. I really want to give something. And so I really should do this. And, you know, she's 10 years younger than me, and she's doing it, so sure I should do it even more. The reality of the situation was that I was so scared. And unintentionally, my friend was telling me stories about how great it was, but she was also saying, you know, you really have to be prepared that they're just all over you. you know, the kids, they need so much that they just kind of all over you physically and emotionally. You just have no space. You really need to be prepared. And I was getting even more scared. And I was remembering all the interactions I had with possibly the same street children on the platforms of the railway stations when they're begging for food and how intense that was. But I thought, I'll get through it. I'll make myself go. And so I made an appointment with her to meet her one day and go together. And I left the two friends I was traveling with and went to meet her. And as I was walking to the meeting place, I could just feel my steps getting heavier and heavier, slower and slower, and just this sense of this immense weight. I really want to do this, but this is just so hard. I'm so scared. And this part of my memory is still suppressed. I don't know exactly what happened. I know that I didn't go. And I have a few different versions in my head of what actually happened. One of them was that I went and I met her and I said, I can't come. Another was that I went, I met her, and I told a lie of why I couldn't come. I said something came up or whatever, you know, I can't come. And the third is that I told her the truth, but then when I went back to meet my friends, I told them a lie about why I didn't go. So somewhere in there, there was a lie. So what happened in that situation? And it's been very interesting for me for the memory to resurface and just to look at it now. So there was this intense fear and the feeling that I should really do it. So a lot of pushing of myself, of forcing of myself. And the result of that combination ended up being not exactly what I wished for. So some amount of harm to myself and all these people are still my friends somehow, so I don't know what happened, but some degree of harm to myself and to the relationship with somebody, because I couldn't be honest with where I was. Not to myself, not to my friends. And the reason I'm sharing this story, because this is the first part of a bodhisattva practice, is first of all, we turn our soft seeing to ourselves. And we have to be honest. Where am I? What is happening within me right now in this situation? And when we do that as the first step, then we can find the next one. But if we don't do that, like me in that situation, then not always, of course, but we can cause harm. And so, what is another way of being? Of opening, of looking, of opening with kindness, with soft eyes, soft seeing, at the reality of where I am. And it's not just an easy way out. It's not just that that's okay, so I'll be kind to myself, I can't do this. I'll go and have pizza instead. There's good pizza in Varanasi. That's not what it's about. It's about then working with that vulnerability that I see. With that fragility that is exposed. and remembering that the wish to help is real. And the fear is real. So how do I bring the two together? How do I move from there? And for me, through meditation practice, the ability to see softly, to give space, to allow what is there to be, is what also supports the ability to challenge myself, to not stop in my comfort zone, but to take another step, even if it's tiny. Even if it's tiny. And remembering that all of this is nourishing, watering the trees that I spoke about a little while ago. That all this authentic, honest contact with our experience, with the way we are, with imperfection, with what we don't like, all of this is manure, is fertilizer. It nourishes something true. And it's all connected to this feeling place that I spoke of earlier as well. In Pali, in Buddhist terminology, this place is called Bodhicitta, the awakened heart. Bodhi is awakened. Citta is heart. The heart that is awake. And it's sometimes spoken about as the part in our heart that feels this deep longing to, this is a really hard word, alleviate, to heal suffering in ourselves and in the world. The awakened heart. This is the awakened heart. This is the definition of an awakened heart. The heart that longs deeply to heal suffering in ourselves and in the world. And I think we all felt that very much in Liat's story today when she was speaking in this morning. That sense of deep, intense longing to bring healing, to bring fairness. To bring wholeness. And the great thing about this bodhicitta and about being a bodhisattva in general is that it's not something that we work towards and reach somewhere. It's not a degree that we receive after studying in university an X amount of years. It's something that we can do right now. It's actually, in this room, something we're all doing already. So we're all bodhisattvas, because we came here because we have bodhicitta. Because we feel this in ourselves. And being a bodhisattva doesn't mean being perfect. Actually, it means a lot of the time quite the opposite. It doesn't mean being perfect. It means being willing to see and being willing to work with, to take on the practice of being alive. So, Pema Chodron, who's one of the great contemporary teachers of this kind of practice and tradition, she says, you know, we're all baby bodhisattvas. And I really like this image. And, you know, we can be baby bodhisattvas again and again. It's like you can't fail at this. And that's all we need to be, and we'll grow at our own pace. But to be connected to that part of ourselves, even if it's just a small whisper, even if we have no clarity about where to follow it to. But just to know, I have this goodness. And actually, most human beings have. Maybe in specific limited situations. But most human beings have this. And so this is really important to remember, because we're still a bodhisattva, even when we feel closed, even when we feel angry, even when we judge, even when we feel confused. Whatever we feel, whatever our direct experience is, underneath that is what Pema Chodron calls the soft spot, which is another way of saying this awakened heart. Underneath that, that feeling place is there. That caring place is there. And if we remember that, we can take our anger and look at it. And we can take our anger as something that connects us, not something that disconnects us. And anger is a great example. If we think of the experience of being angry, we feel very disconnected. It's me against something, against the bottle. Why do I have such a crap bottle, and why did Nathan buy it? So now I'm against Nathan. It's his fault. Or whatever it is, I'm angry, I'm against. But if I kind of change the rules a little bit, and I feel anger, and I accept that anger is a human experience, it's a human emotion, and right at this point when I'm feeling angry, there's countless human beings on this planet right now who are experiencing exactly the same emotion. They're angry. And then I actually look at the anger. And I try and become more familiar with it. And I'm doing that not just for myself. To heal the suffering of myself and all beings. I'm looking at my anger not just for me. When I understand my anger, I can understand someone else's as well. We're not that different. So even the most negative parts of ourselves are places where we can actually transform. And sometimes it's actually those places that have the most power, because there's so much energy in them. So sometimes what I don't like about this practice is that you can't run away from it. You know, I'm fed up with something and I want to be fed up. I don't want this bodhisattva voice popping up in my head. Oh, just look at this experience of being fed up, you know. What can you learn? How can you grow? Shut up. But there's also beauty in it. every moment, every experience is an opportunity to be alive, to practice, to grow, to find out what it is to be a full human being, to grow my bodhisattva roots. A friend of mine in the States who was doing a lot of teaching meditation in prisons told me the story about a woman he was working with, and kind of fits here, so I'm going to tell it. If you haven't figured it out yet, I like stories. So this meditation teacher, I think she was in her 40s, was teaching meditation in quite a serious prison somewhere in the States. And the prisoners that she was working with were all there for long periods of time. They'd all committed quite serious crimes. And one of the conditions the prison wanted to put in place for her to have a meditation class there, she's a woman, they're men, was to have prison officers in the room with them, guarding. And that just didn't feel right to her. And so she really had a long process of, you know, saying, I see where you're coming from, but that would kind of, it wouldn't feel right to be teaching meditation, to ask people to open when they're being observed by the guards. And so eventually they got to some compromise. I think they had a camera in there or something, but they could still keep an eye, but it wasn't so such a obvious presence. And so she was teaching meditation for a few months with these group of, I don't know, 8 or 10 big men. And they had, you know, a reasonably good connection. She was coming every week and they were progressing along. And one day, there was a power cut during the meditation group session. So the lights went out, the camera went out, and she was standing there, feeling quite afraid. She was kept hearing rustlings in the room, not knowing what was going on. And after, you know, just a few moments, doesn't take very long, the power came back on, and she found herself standing in the center of a circle, and all around her were the men, and each of them had moved forward to protect her in case someone else. And so this is the kind of power we're talking about. A soft power that can, in trusting someone else, we can transform also the conditioned way they've been taught to behave. So a ring of protectors around her. Pema Chodron has a lot of quotes I love, but one of them is, I'm not going to remember it. One of them is, what we do for ourselves benefits others. And what we do for others benefits us. And she's talking about this in relationship to this type of practice, of understanding the connection between myself and everything else. Nothing is separate, including ourselves, even though it feels like that a lot of the time. So when I give trust, that changes the experience of the person that I trust. When I find peace within myself, that affects the world around me. When I'm honest, about what I can do, what is possible for me, it allows me to move from that place, and that movement affects others beneficially as well as myself. So, another small example of this is from the weekends that we do in Palestine. And I think we've been doing these about 2 years now, of just taking Israelis to sleep one night in a Palestinian village and doing some work in the village the next day. And when I first went to the village and stayed a night there, I didn't sleep the whole night, the first night. And I was amazed at how much fear I had. How much fear I had. And of course, during the night, the stories came and you know, it's not like they're ridiculous. Like, what are you doing? You don't know these people. And surely, even if they're okay, there's someone else in the village that might want to hurt me. And so, every sound I heard in the night was someone trying to break in. And the next morning, when we talked to each other, it ended up that most Israelis in the group had a similar experience. It was a mixed group that time, Israelis and internationals. Most of the Israelis had that same experience. And this repeated itself. Time after time after time. Not the same person again, but people who came for the first time wouldn't sleep the first night. That was pretty much, kind of got used to it, and it was like, okay, kind of woke up in the morning waiting to hear. And then this recent May, I think it was, and we'd already done, I don't remember, several of these weekends and groups and whatever. And we realized, kind of halfway through the work day the next morning, we said, did anyone say to you that they hadn't slept well last night? And, you know, I said to Sheila, a friend who organizes the weekends with us, and she said, no one mentioned anything. So we asked around. And it turned out that everyone slept fine. And that's the way it's been since. And for me, it felt like we kind of got to a critical point. So enough people had slept in that house, in that village, and faced their fear, that other people who came, didn't know them, never met, exact same situation, it was gone. They didn't have that same experience. So it sounds wacky. It sounds crazy. But I have no other explanation. I have no other explanation than that it's possible when we deal with, you know, it's a small event, sleeping one night in a village. And we do it enough, and enough of us do it together. Something shifts that can affect others as well. So we can be the change we want to see in the world. That's another, it's a Gandhi quote, but he was also a bodhisattva, obviously. We can. In little ways, or big ways. So sometimes we can't change reality. Most of the time we can't change reality. But we can work with our relationship to it. And that's a lot. I had another experience in the olive harvests with someone I met teaching a retreat here, actually, a meditation retreat with Dovana. And he happened to live in a settlement in the West Bank. And he heard me talking about the olive harvest that we do, and he really wanted to join. He wanted to come one day to meet his neighbors and to work to help them harvest, to actually see the situation. And I could feel his goodness. And I wanted to support that. It didn't matter that I don't agree with his decision of where to live. And it was so hard to make it happen. Because he wanted to go, but he didn't want to lie about who he was. Which is fine, understandable, acceptable. But the Palestinians weren't sure that they, how they felt about having someone from a settlement come and help harvest. And even when there was a Palestinian friend who felt completely fine with it, he couldn't guarantee how his friends would feel or how the families we were going to work with would feel. So it's a real complicated situation. And that's the reality. The situation is so complicated that it's complicated. And so we ended up making just, I don't even remember how many phone calls back and forth and just staying with. So he says this, so what do you say to that? And how's this? And how's that? And the night before, eventually, we got the okay, somehow. Just with that steadiness of, okay, let's just keep going. Let's just weave this web of good intentions. Weave the web of goodness. Of meeting bodhisattva meeting bodhisattva. Goodness meeting goodness. And it wasn't great. It wasn't fantastic. It wasn't that they ended up being lifelong friends. Or that it changed their outlook, as far as I know. I don't know, it was a year ago. But at the end of the day, the Palestinian host said to the Israeli guest, is it okay if I give you a call sometime? And he said, yeah. And even if nothing happened, just that day, felt like sowing a seed of goodness in the world, of something that may be possible. So we can't always change reality, but we can work with our relationship to it. We can do small things. Mother Teresa, one of my favorite quotes again. We can do no great things, but we can do small things with great love. Another bodhisattva, obviously. And we also have to know with this fire, with this longing to heal suffering, that it's not a continuous line. Sometimes it blazes and it energizes us. And sometimes we can barely see a little ember glowing. It can feel very weak. But it has a life. It has a movement. And by cultivating gentle attentiveness, a quality of attention, we keep contact with that. We keep movement with that. And by coming back to our intention, which is something we've been speaking about a lot without actually speaking about it. How important intention is. And remembering our good intentions. Even when we have no control over the outcome of our actions. And even if we forget, and we become involved in something else, and the bodhisattva fire burns out. We just need to light it again. Which isn't so hard. usually we can find another bodhisattva fire not too far away, and we can just take a little light from there and light again. And again and again and again, as many times as we need on this journey through life. I had this image when I was preparing this talk of what happens to us when we let life be the wind and the water that forms our hearts. And the image was like pieces of glass who get thrown in the sea and get rubbed by the sea and the sand. I'm sure we've all found these. And they become like a precious stone. They're so beautiful and smooth. We can rub them on our skin and look at them and be touched by the beauty. So that's what happens to us. And I'd like to end with a quote, which is apparently one of the Dalai Lama's favorites, another bodhisattva. And it comes from an old text called The Way of the Bodhisattva by a sage called Shantideva, who lived many centuries ago. And it talks about this aspiration that Shiri was speaking about this afternoon, of kind of the ultimate bodhisattva growth, the mature bodhisattva, not the baby anymore, which in the Tibetan tradition is someone who not only dedicates this life to working with suffering, but also chooses to actively come back. And so Shantideva says, and apparently the Dalai Lama repeats this every day, "And now, as long as space endures, as long as there is space in the world, as long as there are beings to be found, may I continue likewise to remain, to drive away the sorrows of the world. May I continue likewise to remain, to drive away the sorrows of the world." Let's take a few minutes to rest in ourselves. Support and a nourishment to healing of suffering everywhere, including in ourselves. May all beings dwell in the goodness of an awakened heart. May we all be free and live in love, in peace, and in safety.